So in the last three episodes, I looked into how is it that healers who practice African spirituality end up opening or starting their own churches. There were three vastly different stories that for me showed the breadth of how diverse African spirituality is, even as it functions within something as common as the church. But in all three episodes, there was a thread that I picked up. There was a common aspect amongst all of them, even though the stories were so different from one another. And that was the presence of Isithunywa. At a very basic level, on the face of it, Isithunywa is a spirit that some healers carry that functions within the church. It is a spirit that for certain reasons uses certain mechanisms of the Christian faith in the healing process of African modalities. I've spent time trying to understand what Isithunywa is and how is it that it came to function within the Christian faith. And I feel like this was the missing part from the three episodes. Not necessarily understanding Isithunywa technically, but it in its context and how is it that it came to be. I've always wondered whether is Isithunywa a new kind of a spirit that came somehow with the colonizing missionaries, or is it an ancient spirit that somehow evolved into Isithunywa, or is it something completely different from what we understand it to be? Now, I have to say that the definition of Isithunywa actually varies from different kind of practice to another, or even from one healer to another. The definition varies within the context of each person or each group, so to say. So then I felt like maybe if we approached it historically, we can have some kind of a common understanding. So in this episode, we are going to do a deep dive into the origins of Isithunywa and how it came to be. And the more I looked, the more it turned out that what we perceive or understand as Isithunywa today is actually the story of two men, both born in the 1700s, and how their individual journeys through spirituality came to define what we, to this very day, define as Isithunywa. Let's do it. The two men who came to shape what today is called Isithunywa were a man called Makhanda and another called Untsikana. These were two Xhosa men born in the 1700s who both encountered the spirit that functioned within the church, but were also healers in and of themselves. One of them, Untsikana, came to found the very first African-initiated church in history. Yet both men had divergingly different views of how Isithunywa can function, or rather how African spirituality can function within the church. Their views were so opposed to each other that in some ways they became enemies. One came to define the very core of how African spirituality functioned within the church, and the other was almost drowned out by history. One felt that African spirituality can coexist with the Christian faith, and the other felt that for that to happen, it would need to happen within the terms of Africans themselves, and not as a submission to to Western European colonizers. Umakanda and Untsikana lived in the same time period, around the same area, which means that in many ways they had very similar kinds of life experiences and influences. The contrast between them being that Makanda's expression of spirituality had a militant character that found a home in the African church but also challenged its coloniality. For one thing, both men were healers in and of themselves, but Umakanda was Itola, a war doctor. He prepared soldiers spiritually for wars, wars in which sometimes he was their leader. The man known as Makanda, after whom Grahamstown today is named, later came to be called Unxele, the left-handed one. He was born around 1750 to a Xhosa father and a Khoi mother, and there are some who believe that his spiritual gifts came by way of his mother's lineage. Makanda was born to the Rharhabe people. In some ways, Rharhabe has been known as the Xhosa Shaka Zulu because of his warlike approach to ruling. Incidentally, Makanda was born in a time of war. The British colonialists and the Xhosa nations had been locked in bitter battles over land and territory. And from a young age, he was familiar with the Christian faith, having grown up in a farm, and he was familiar with the religious concepts such as sin. In fact, there were times when he was so enveloped by religious fervor that he would sometimes go on prolonged fasts as a way of trying to atone for the sins of his people. There were times where it actually seemed like Makanda had become suicidal. The people, on the other hand, got so annoyed with him that they literally tied him up and gagged him. And it was at this point that a man called Qalanga appeared. Qalanga recognized that Makanda's odd behavior was in fact signs of ingulo.
Xa kuthethwa ngokugula apha uyaqonda uyabona ngoku uyaqonda uba ndithetha ngokugula uba wayebegula enjani uyaqonda ubegula enganyangeki phakalungi uyaqonda uyagula uyaqonda kuthiwe ke ngoku xana sebeyithetha ke ngoku kakuhle kuthiwe lo mntu unengulo yesixhosa uyaqonda uyagula ugulela ugula ngesixhosa akanawunyango wakhe uyawunyangwa esixhoseni isintu.
Ingulo is a spiritual affliction within Xhosa belief systems, which meant that a person had spiritual calling from the ancestors. Uqalanga then takes the young Makanda to the Ndlambe people and their chief. And it was here that he then enters Intwaso and becomes initiated as a healer.
Batsho bona uyaqonda bathi ke makaqiniseke eguleni agulele phambili uyaqonda ewe azokhula angene ebugqirheni. Ingulo yakhe apho iyawuphelela khona, iyawuphelela uba abe siliqirha uyaqonda.
Even though he is initiated as igqirha and itola, he is still deeply drawn to the Christian faith. He feels such a profound connection to the religion that he begins to study it with the aim of finding ways of merging his spiritual practice as a healer with the tenets of the Christian faith and the Bible. His vision is that of a Christian faith that coexists with the African expression of spirituality. And what fascinates him about Christianity is not just its philosophy, but the practicality of its application when it comes to the supernatural. In this regard, what really intrigues him is the story of the resurrection of Christ. For Makanda, the rising of Jesus from the dead was not just a sign that Jesus was somehow special, but it meant that bringing people from the dead as a spiritual practice was possible. And this is because for him, Christianity meant access to a different kind of spiritual capacity. It was not a system that was premised on whiteness. It was not about an individual abandoning their cultural identity. But Rather, he believed that Christianity was a spiritual skill, a modality that one could master, and becoming Christ-like was not something that was out of reach. In fact, it was something that a gifted person and a determined person could achieve. So he goes about engaging with missionaries to explore these concepts, and these engagements at some point began to go downhill. Around 1816, Makanda saw himself as a peer of the missionaries. He believed that he and them were on the same mission of spiritual liberation of the African people, and in this regard, he had been instrumental in helping to spread the gospel amongst his own people. But then, very soon, Makanda begins to realize that the missionaries obfuscate their interpretation of scripture with whiteness. It soon became clear to him that the missionaries intend to use Christianity as a tool to subjugate African people, that they want to use the story of Christ as an instrument of racial and cultural exclusion and domination. It is here then that his theology begins to change. For one thing, he believes that white people killed Jesus Christ, and as punishment, God exiled them from their own land and cast them across the oceans. He believes that this is why the white people came to the continent. And with the creation of that cosmology, he now viewed the colonists as a cursed people who are bent on causing harm. I have to remind you that Makanda was not just an ordinary healer. He was Itola, a war doctor. Later in life, he became the senior advisor to the chief, and his particular specialty was in the spiritual sciences of warfare, and he had now found himself on the spiritual battleground against the colonial powers. And this set him on a direct collision course with another African, a young man by the name of Untsikana. And the outcome of this collision defined what Isithunywa is to black people to this very day. The story of how Untsikana became the most consequential figure in the history of African religious experience starts one morning, possibly around 1815, when he was in his 30s. That morning, Untsikana was in his kraal with one of his sons. As the morning sun rose in the east, he was standing next to one of his favorite cows, Ukuluse, when he noticed a particular bright ray of sunlight hit Ukuluse between the eyes. The light seems brighter than the normal glow of the sun. And as Untsikana looks closer, he falls into a trance and passes out. When he awakes, he asks his son if he saw the bright light that was coming from the cow, but the boy says no, he didn't. When Untsikana recalls this incident, he said that in that moment that something entered him. Later that same day, Untsikana attended a wedding celebration along with his family. And as is the case with African weddings, there was dancing. The particular dance in Isixhosa is called ukuqhenza. And as Untsikana began ukuqhenza, a strong wind started swirling around him. When he noticed that this was happening, he stopped dancing and he sat down. After some time, he started dancing again and the same thing happened. And then he sat down again. This happened 3 times. Until Untsikana decided to leave the ceremony entirely. As he walked home, he passed by a river. And the story goes that Unzikana went into the river. In those days, as is the case today, amaXhosa used to put red clay, imbola, on their faces and on their bodies as a kind of skin treatment, but also partly for aesthetics. It was such a defining practice amongst amaXhosa that sometimes they were called abantu ababomvu, the red people. And the story goes that Unzikana went into the river and put his hands in the water and washed his face and washed his body, the water turning red around him as he washed away the clay. The following day, they find Unzikana at the entrance of his kraal again. He is humming a strange chant, something that sounded familiar, but still strange. He turned to the people and told them that they had to start praying, which they did. And from that day onwards, people met regularly in Unzikana's hut and they sang, and they sang hymns and they prayed. And then it is there, in that hut, that the very first African initiated church begins. There are a number of elements to this story that came to define how isiThunywa functions today that we'll discuss later. But the main one right now is that Unzikana's encounter with spirit happened by itself. It did not happen in church. There was no overseeing it. It was not conducted by another person. It wasn't recognized by another person. All Unzikana could say was that on that day, something entered him. The extent to which Unzikana was familiar with the Christian faith is a matter of debate. Some say that he had come across colonial missionaries who had introduced him to Christianity, but even then, he strongly opposed being baptized by them. And some say Unzikana had very little knowledge about Christianity at that point. But nonetheless, Unzikana encountered spirit, and he affirms this by saying that something had entered him. And in the story, the presence of spirit manifests in the appearance of a wind as he began to dance. Then he goes to the river and does what his followers described as a self-baptism. This process brings into the picture the element of water, not just as a bridge between the physical world and the spiritual realm, as had been the case with African beliefs for centuries, but now it also connected the world of African spiritual practice and the Christian faith. Ritual cleansing and religious baptism now become one and the same thing. The two worlds collide, and it is here that I believe that the spirit entity takes form, in that space between the religious and the cultural. And this entity, this thing that Unzikana said entered him, is isiThunywa. And it was Unzikana who shaped what isiThunywa came to be to this day. Born in 1780 amongst a Xhosa chiefdom called amaGcaleka, Unzikana enters history during a time when amaXhosa are locked in battle with the European missionaries intent on destroying the black people's culture on the one side and the British colonialists wanting to take all of their land on the other. He was a spiritual pioneer who bridged the gap between African cultural practice and Christianity into a form that black people could find a home in. What he recognized, Unzikana, very early on in his life was that spiritual domination can easily lead to political and economic domination of a people. One of the ways he finds for these two worlds to coexist is by developing a philosophy of nonviolence. After becoming a royal advisor, he denounces wars, especially those fought amongst the black people themselves. This doctrine of nonviolence became pivotal in growing the church, and later would become nearly fatal for black people. But the challenge at the time Unzikana faced was that he couldn't deny his spiritual encounter. The entity that had entered him had now began to reshape his life. For one thing, he also denounces polygamy by divorcing one of his wives and turning away from some aspects of African spiritual practice, such as bloodletting. But he also refuses to embrace Western culture. He refuses to accept whiteness as the epitome of the Christian faith or the Christian identity. He is intent on finding an expression of the Christian faith that does not intend to dominate or demonize black people. One of the ways that he does this is that he never left his community after his conversion to join a white church, which was customary back in those days. He remained amongst his people and conducted services in a way that made sense to them. The structure of a church service that Ntsikana developed was made up of three activities, namely the composition of hymns, preaching, and prophecy. On the face of it, these look similar to how other churches conduct services. In practice, though, they are worlds apart. Ntsikana was a gifted public speaker, a profound orator who understood the power of language. He understands the power of the African language, not just in its words, but also in how people speak. White preachers stand in front of their congregation and give intellectual lectures. Ntsikana, understanding the poetry of language and the depth and emotion of metaphors and the power of speaking from the heart, he doesn't give lectures. He gives a performance. That is a form of Xhosa poetry executed by Imbongi, a praise singer. This form of art is common amongst most indigenous people across the continent. And this is an example of a Xhosa sermon in a church. The two are nearly indistinguishable from each other. And this is what Ntsikana recognized over 200 years ago. He recognized that delivering scripture in the tone and cadence and rhythm that his people were familiar with, in the poetry that his people were rooted in and in their identity, was far more powerful than just creating a facade of civility and sophistication. He also came to appreciate the role of prophecy in the lives of the people whose entire existence was beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish missionaries and the tyranny of an evil empire. Sharing with people prophetic messages helped to give them some sense of control in an unknown future. It offered a kind of transcendent certainty that held their very sanity together. But it was in crafting hymns that Ntsikana left an undying mark in the landscape of religious spirituality. During that time, amaXhosa believed in the Creator God. They called that God by several names, like Umdali, the Creator, or Umenzi, the Maker. But most of amaXhosa called God uQamata. Through intermarriage with the Khoi, the name uThixo was used by some people. The most famous of all hymns that Ntsikana composed was uLothixo uMkhulu, the hymn that is sung to this very day. The significance of this hymn is in the title. Before the hymn came into being, missionaries had had a difficult time with coming up with a translation of the word God into isiXhosa. The challenge that they had was that they wanted black people to believe that whatever conception they have of God was inferior to the Christian God. They believed names like uQamata represented a pagan God, So they couldn't use those existing forms of titles within the Bible or within the teachings of the Christianity to black people. So when Ntsikana's song began to spread and the missionaries realized how he had blended it with the philosophy of nonviolence, as well as his stance against traditional practices, they officially adopted the title of Otiko into the Bible translations of God. I have to emphasize that it was Ntsikana's influence in songwriting in a hymn that was composed over 200 years ago that black Christians believe today that Otiko is a Christian God. And it was through isithunywa sika Ntsikana that black Christians today call God Otiko, because they also then adopted the belief that Uqamata was a pagan god. It was isithunywa sika Ntsikana that gave him the capacity to create transcendent music. It is here then Ntsikana and Umakhanda come into conflict. For Umakhanda, Uthixo was the god of the white people. Uthixo was the god of whiteness and colonialism. He believed that the god of the African people was the greater god that he called Umdali Dipu. And according to him, Ntsikana's version of Christianity was ultimately subservient to the colonizers. He wanted a more militant approach where European Christianity was not only avoided but confronted. Ultimately, the two men's divergent beliefs led them into two different paths. It was almost like Black Panther and Killmonger. Ntsikana believed in diplomacy and Makhanda believed in violence. Makhanda fought literal battles against the colonizers. And eventually, he would be arrested and was sent to prison on Robben Island. And later, during a frantic escape attempt, Umakhanda and some of his followers got onto a boat which capsized off the coast, and Makhanda drowned, and his body was never found. Ntsikana, on the other hand, had followers, some of whom were educated, and managed to archive his life and his teachings, especially his hymns. This leaves one to wonder how indigenous churches would have been like if it was Makhanda's militant isiThunywa that had shaped the African church, if the African expression of Christianity had rejected everything to do with whiteness and European culture. Ntsikana's interpretation of isiThunywa was tested in 1957 with the introduction of the Witchcraft Suppression Act. This act made any kind of practice of African belief illegal, primarily through a vague classification of anything outside of Christianity being deemed to be witchcraft. During this period, many gifted people had to hide their gifts and their practices. Many people then found refuge within the church, especially African-initiated churches. And it was through this time that isiThunywa became a way through which some people were able to exist within the two worlds of religion and culture. Isithunywa became such a refuge. My understanding, my interpretation is that isithunywa is an example of how spirit can evolve to meet a people where they are, to be cognizant of the realities of people's lives. Isithunywa was a gift to people. It was a gift from spirit to people, because spirit understood what people were going through. It became a cover. In many ways, isiThunywa was not a turning away from African spiritual practice, but rather a stripping down, a way of offloading some of the practices so that the people could still function in the society that deemed them to be practitioners of dark magic. It needed to move lighter. It needed to be more nimble. It needed to use less things, because people were dispossessed and people didn't have land and people didn't have their own homes and people were completely disconnected from a lot of things that their spirituality was initially and historically rooted in. In that sense, isiThunywa was a gift to the people, that this is how you're going to survive through this period of suppression and dispossession and abuse, because internally, in many ways, it delivered the same kind of healing, although it used different mechanisms. I believe that isiThunywa came into being within that space between culture and religion. It came into being at a time when people needed it. It was not necessarily a new spirit, but it evolved into something that hadn't been there before, because Christianity is not ancient to Black people. It didn't exist from the beginning of time.
It is important to remember that Ntsikana's defining approach to the meeting of African spiritual beliefs and the incoming Christian faith was nonviolence. And I believe that it is part of why the idea of people hiding in the church or hiding their gift in the church became almost easier to do, because he had instilled that sense of nonviolence in the dynamic between Christianity and cultural practices. So when all these acts came about and all these laws came about, it was easier to conform than to fight. And another thing is that what happened with Ntsikana's followers after his death is also fundamentally important to understanding how Isithunywa functions today. Because he insisted on retaining the cultural self while embracing the spiritual other, it is Ntsikana's personhood that is seen as a bridge between the Black people and the Christian God. His metaphysical image becomes then crucial to Black people's sense of belonging within Christianity. And as a result, he becomes almost deified in the eyes of his spiritual descendants, in the eyes of his followers at the time. He is not only seen as a teacher or a leader, but he is viewed as a component of the functioning of the spiritual process. In fact, some of his followers came to call him Ntsikana Ongcwele, Ntsikana, the Holy One. And had Ntsikana been a white man within the Catholic faith, the reverence that his followers had for him would have most certainly seen him canonized as a saint. This then helps you understand why is it that with many indigenous churches today, the African-initiated churches today, the leader, the founder, is also seen as a component of the functioning of spirituality for those people, for that congregation. It is seeing the portrait of Joseph Lekhanyane, the leader of the ZCC, in just about every home of a member of the church, or just about every car of a member of the Nazareth Baptist Church or Ama Nazareta have a sticker of Unyazi Ushembe on the boot or dangling on the rearview mirror. These were dynamics that were set in place by how Ntsikana approached spirituality and Christianity at the same time. And while we were raised, many of us, to believe that African spiritual practices were demonic, those of us who grew up in the church, the people who took us to church and taught us about Christianity, our mothers, our grandmothers, who all became Abomama Bomthandazo, they knew at their core that the African spiritual dynamic still functioned within them. They just couldn't let it be known, because that knowledge came at a cost. And it is here that I want to share with you a clip from a previous podcast that I had made, where I went to a church service. It was a memorial service for one of the prominent Abomama Bomthandazo in the area that I grew up in. And this is what happened. When I was still doing research on Abomama Bomthandazo, I spent some time with my mother as she went about her women's manyano duties. One day, I went with her to a memorial service of one of the elderly ladies from her church. It was on a Thursday, naturally. I sat at the back of the church, and in front of me was a sea of multicolored manyano uniform from every denomination in the area. It was here that something happened that changed my whole view and understanding of Abomama Bomthandazo. As is the nature of memorial services, some of Abomama got up and shared kind words and fond memories of the lady who had passed, and then they would sing intermittently in between. The church was hot and the windows were slim, which didn't help much. As the singing intensified, I saw an elderly lady slump violently to one side, landing on the woman who was sitting next to her. The singing didn't stop though. Very few people paid much notice. The lady who had to catch the one who had fallen over waved another lady over, and the two of them carried the one who was struggling to the outside of the church. As they walked past me, I could tell that the lady hadn't collapsed from heat exhaustion, nor was she taken by her grief over the death of her friend. This lady, an elder woman, probably well into her 60s, was in an ancestral trance. This wasn't just any kind of ancestral trance. It was the kind that happens to people who have never learned how to be in sync with idlozi, people who have never been to a pehlweni. After a few minutes, another lady disappeared down into the rows of uniforms, and she too was carried out. Same symptoms. At some point, there was a lady dressed in blue and white uniform who was standing in the front. She was deep in the throes of an intense prayer when she froze as the telltale signs of idlozi began to reverberate through her. One lady shouted, "Mbambeni uzowa," and two ladies jumped up and ushered her to the outside. Yet, this wasn't even the most shocking part. As the third lady was carried out, I decided to step outside because I could no longer handle the heat in the church. And what I found outside shook me to the core. The first lady who had been carried out had now recovered, and she was standing on her own drinking a bottle of water. The last lady to be carried out was still struggling. The two women who had carried her out were administering the exact same remedies that Abu Gobel administered to an uninitiated person who falls into trance at a Sangoma ceremony. The exact same remedies. But this was a church, a Christian church, packed full of Abomama Bomthandazo. Not only were some of them falling into ancestral trances, but no one seemed surprised by this. Not only were they not surprised, they knew exactly what to do to help. We are all familiar with the narrative of the woman who had a calling and ran away to the church. There are many young women today who have been told that the reason they have a calling, or the reason why their calling is manifesting in a destructive way in their lives, is because their grandmother ran away from her calling. Now, here I was, in a church full of grandmothers, some of whom had ran away from their calling. And here they were, falling into ancestral trance, right in the middle of the church. And in that very church, they were being helped using ancestral remedies. It was in that moment that I realized that these women hadn't run away from their calling. There's nowhere really for a black woman to run to in this country. I started to look back at all the research that I had done and all that I had learned, and a heavy question entered my mind. What were they supposed to do? Your grandmother, your great-grandmother, what was she supposed to do? It was the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s. The trauma of oppression was not a distant past. It was the very air that they breathed. Much worse was still to come. I mean, apartheid hadn't even been invented yet. By the 1950s, unemployment amongst women was at around 90%. And that 10% who had jobs, mostly working as maids, they had to be Christian in order to get those jobs. She needed a Christian name for her white madams to feel comfortable with her existence, much more so her presence in their home. In 1957, the Witchcraft Suppression Act was passed and it deemed it illegal to be a sangoma. It was illegal to be a healer. It was a criminal offense. You could go to jail. What was she supposed to do? What more could she carry when she was already carrying her entire people on her breath? Your grandmother didn't run away from her calling. As Ugogo Mlondolozi once said, your calling never stops calling. Church doesn't cure idlozi. It never did, and it never will. There are those who asked for some reprieve from the ancestors. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. The rest, they took their calling to the church because there they knew that they would find maybe someone who would help them carry the burden. Maybe they ran to the church for Jesus. Maybe there's something in the idea of a man willing to die for the sake of a woman. Can you imagine that? A man willing to die for the sake of a black woman. We can speculate religion all we want, but what is a solid and undeniable fact is that in the church, black women found each other. As I stood and watched as one mother after another succumbed to spirit, no one stood back in disgust. No one called out witch in scorn. Instead, they kept on singing. They carried each other in song. They carried each other in prayer. And when the load got too much, they carried each other by their bare hands and summoned the most ancient of their ancestors, because you don't pray someone out of an ancestral trance. Your grandmother took her calling to the church and turned everyone in the family against African beliefs because she hoped that in doing so, no child or grandchild of hers would have to carry such a burden. Your grandmother turned your mother against African beliefs because your grandmother knew that if she didn't turn her daughter against African beliefs, then her daughter stood absolutely no chance in this world. Leave those things alone and go to church, your grandmother said to her daughter. And in her heart, she whispered, because you don't know what this world will do to you if you don't. Your mother did as she was told. Now Ugogo is back as idlozi lakho, and your mother doesn't believe you because that's not the mother that she knew. That is a matter between your mother and her mother. Honor your grandmother in the best way that you can under the circumstances that your life allows. Leave the rest. Maybe all you know is the brutality and abuse that came with a mother who was more devoted to the church than to her own children's emotional well-being. Maybe that pristine uniform inflicted wounds that cut right to your soul. Maybe it is a wound that has never healed because it is ripped open almost every day. I am sorry that this happened to you. I am deeply and sincerely sorry that this happened to you. It was never, ever your fault. We can gather in our technological wokeness and the hindsight that history affords us and castigate our mothers and grandmothers. But I leave you with this. What will your great-grandchildren, what will your grandchildren say about you? What will their cry be to you? Yeah!
Bye.